Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
Wednesday afternoon here on 720 WGN along Michigan Avenue in the Allstate Showcase Studio on this summer afternoon. We'll start with Terry Savage, as we usually do a little bit later. Frank Sennett will be here. And then last segment today, we're going to talk to the folks at Redbox. You know, they're headquartered not too far away, Oak Brook Terrace, and they are adding kiosks in this era of diminishing rentals. I think rentals are down, or were down 18% maybe last year. But the kiosks, they cut some a year or two ago, but they're bringing back even more. So that's coming up later in the program. Right now, say hello to Terry Savage. Welcome back to the Business Lunch, Terry.
Always happy to be here on Wednesdays with you, even though it's a down day, down 50 points on the Dow.
Did you hear Ori, and I know you like to listen to his business reports before we start,
yeah,
that Fitch was considering lowering our bond rating if we don't raise the debt soon?
Wait a second. That was I rolled my eyes because, first of all, I think it was Mitch McConnell said there is no chance in the world that we are going to default on our debt or not raise the debt ceiling. I mean, they're Republicans. They're supposed to be conservative, but they are not going to grind this country to a halt. So they will raise the debt ceiling when it comes up the minute they get back. There'll be a lot of headlines and a lot of everything. So I don't know why Fitch tried to get some headlines by saying, and if you don't raise your debt ceiling, which remember when they fought over it in the past, has brought the government to a halt. Not a bad idea, maybe, but threatened to default on our debt, which is impossible. So that's not going to happen. That's just not going to happen.
So you think Fitch was just making noise? You think Fitch was just making noise?
I don't know why Fitch wanted to make some headlines. I mean, who asked?
Maybe it came up from the president speaking last night. He was talking about shutting down the government if he doesn't get his wall there, and that's not the same as raising the debt ceiling. But if the president doesn't get his Mexican wall, he says he's going to shut down the government.
No comment. I mean, let's talk about something we can deal with.
Well,
okay, I mean.
Art Cashin, the guy who manages the floor for UBS, said today that he doesn't think traders have fully, and maybe this means they don't really take the president at his word, but that they haven't taken fully to heart the president's comments last night that he doesn't think there's going to be a NAFTA deal done. What happens if there isn't a NAFTA deal? That's a pretty big deal here.
Okay, now that's serious. That is serious. First of all, I was looking at the housing field, which we might talk about in a minute, but lumber comes from Canada, and when we've had problems, that raises the cost of homes even more than home prices are going up now. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine there won't be a NAFTA deal. One of the weirdest provisions that they're arguing over is something, it's not Proposition 19, it's something 19, which says that the way you resolve disputes will be not in the world court, but in trade panels, which, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, we've had a pretty fair results from those disputes. You know, I'm finding it harder and harder to discuss things logically because pronouncements about what we're going to do and not do don't come from a point of logic. We have a really good trading relationship on this continent. It's worked well. It might need to be adjusted, but the idea that we wouldn't have a NAFTA deal is so... it's almost ludicrous that so it's hard to talk about what if.
Well, I mean, maybe that was Cashin's point. If the traders aren't taking it, quote unquote, fully to heart, it means that they're not too worried about what the president says at a rally in Phoenix.
I think that's happening a lot. You know, I think you see that a lot. That people are ignoring it to the best they can the things that don't make economic sense anyway. Let's just stick to the economic part of it.
All right. Well, let's go buy a house. Sales, new home sales down quite a bit, down 9.4% from June and down 8.9% from last year. But if you look overall, right, we're still ahead of the pace that we were on last year.
There's no question about it. But the fact, a couple of things are happening. New home sales are dropping, and yesterday we had a report that building permits for new homes and housing starts also were weak. So that leads economists to worry about, gee, that means maybe homes, which are a good portion of the economy, and new homes, which are just under 10% of all home sales in a typical year, that's really not good for the economy. The other half of this picture is not only are sales down, but prices are up sharply. The median sales price is now up to $313,700 of a new home.
Wow.
Okay? And isn't it amazing? Prices are up because of higher costs, land, labor. Let's not even talk about materials like lumber, but materials prices are going up. So we have this unusual situation where the demand is at the low end for people who want to get into the housing market. New homes are pricing them out of the market, and it creates a kind of a ripple effect throughout the economy. So that's not good news.
All right, we'll watch that. But maybe if you're sitting on a ton of copper, that's good news, right? Tell me about the copper prices, global metal prices on the way up.
Well, you know, nobody's talking about this. I mentioned this to you when I was talking before the show. Nobody's taking, I mean, gold prices are creeping up. Gold prices are kind of a reflection of fear and all kinds of global disturbances. And that's the biggest indication, by the way, that the markets aren't taking some of this talk too seriously, because, you know, saying we'll shut down the government used to send gold prices up soaring. They're up $2 an ounce today a little bit. But industrial metals, especially the ones China uses, are up sharply. So you have prices of copper and other industrial commodities moving up. Just something to watch for. So here's what's going to be the Fed. You're charged with keeping inflation under control and keeping the economy growing. So on the weakness side, you have this whole home pitch, new home sales and new home building, and the jobs that go along with new home building if you don't have new home sales. So that means the economy is weak. And on the other side, you have global industrial metal prices going up, China in particular, buying them and using them. So you have to worry a little bit about inflation. We are in a very interconnected world, but not everything moving in the same direction.
All right, that's Terry Savage. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Terry's going to talk about her own personal retirement with us. Not that it's coming.
No, I'm not retiring, ever.
All right, talking with retirement, I just was reading Terry Savage's most recent column about retirement. She writes that 37% of women over 65 live by themselves. More and more women are spending their quote-unquote woman years, and that's divided up through their lifetime, on their own. The idea is that they need to think of retirement and savings on their own as well, and not always as part of a marriage, clearly. I don't know, Terry, are we stating the obvious there?
It's pretty obvious, but somehow it's sort of a hidden thought that women have. You know, I've noticed that there was a new study out that triggered this column called not Sex in the Single Woman, Retirement in the Single Woman. But the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College just came out with a study that shows that no matter what your age, but particularly for middle-aged baby boomers, mid-baby boomers, they call them, women spend fewer years married or in a financial relationship, whether that's a living together relationship. And the message is really louder and clearer. Don't count on anyone else for your retirement security. The second half of that, of course, is the new numbers coming out from Social Security's actuarial tables show that a 60-year-old woman now can expect to live on actuarial average 3 years longer than a man. So whether there is a man in your life, and that was historically the way women planned for retirement, the odds are you will wind up alone, and it requires a different approach to financial planning.
Okay, so
just on my blog, questions about this, and I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Well, so I'm just wondering if the same column could be written about men, but I guess maybe not, because historically we would think of men as why couldn't this be written for men? Just because we tended to rely on men to save for the pension or to create the pension or provide the pension?
You know, this is the tail end of the generation prior to the baby boom.
Okay,
right.
So we're going back in time a little bit.
Exactly.
Okay.
But younger women today still need to know that they will live longer and they need to save more. And they need to be more aware of the kinds of things that happen to older women. You know, I quote this wonderful website, which is 60andme.com, which is a website for for women, older single women, they say, I don't think single or 60 of me, but it says, hey, you know, 30% of women over 65 live by themselves and they enjoy it. But that's not the same as living by yourself at 85.
Right. And so you, the column's got
women
some.
Women don't like to think about that.
And so there's some interesting advice in the column. And I want to ask about a health savings account because I think I didn't understand it. But before we run out of time, one of the things you suggested is to plan with friends, maybe buy a second home with friends or get apartments next to each other so that you are prepared not just financially but physically when that time comes.
Absolutely. And along with that comes the thought of long-term care insurance, especially the new kind where you buy life insurance that combines with long-term care. The whole idea of this column is to open the eyes of women who are now looking around and saying, I never married or I don't have children. Who is going to handle my money? Who can I trust to handle things if I'm not in a position to handle? That's another big issue.
All right, one of the things you suggested, one of the things you wrote about was a health savings account, which I think I must have misunderstood because I always thought of that's the sort of thing that you would use to pay your current expenses, and you seem to write that it's you can save that for medical expenses down the road.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you can. That's all meant to be spent at some point, but not necessarily this year. If you don't spend it this year, it rolls over. It grows tax-free until spent on medical expenses. So it might even pay the premiums ultimately for long-term care insurance. Right. Those are the kinds of things women need to think about.
All right, Terry Savage, great to talk to you. I have a little trouble with your phone line, so I'm going to cut it short a bit. But I appreciate it. We'll see you again next week. Frank sent it on a phone line now from Crane Chicago Business. Frank, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you. And I got two CPS kids, so we're not back until after Labor Day. Right. So my summer continues, man.
Well, your summer didn't begin until later, though, I have a feeling, right?
That's what I was going to say.
Late June. Yeah.
If it's CPS, their summer starts with the 4th of July. All right, let's talk about. So we were. I was talking with Terry Savage earlier today about President Trump and NAFTA last night, saying that he really didn't think there was going to be a deal, and there's talk about whether or not that's believed on Wall Street. But lo and behold, then there is an article. Greg Hines, the political writer, writes a piece about exports and its impact on the Chicago economy. I think I read that it's like 9.9% of the Chicago economy, a couple hundred thousand jobs, so significant, but. We're not doing quite as well as we might. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so we dropped with the exports last year 2.1%, which is close to the 1.9% dip nationally. But the real problem stat that Greg Hines found is that annual growth in exports here since 2003 has only averaged 1.2%, which ranks us 58th out of the 100 largest U.S. metro areas. So we're really lagging behind. We are literally below average.
Okay, so this is going to sound stupid. I don't mind. I tend to think of import-export business being greater on the coasts. And if you are in the middle of the country, maybe you don't have the opportunity. But maybe I'm thinking about exporting maple syrup and not ideas.
Yeah, I think, in terms of the actual shipping, that is true. And in the sense that manufacturing may have dominated on the coast to a certain extent because it's access to those ports and the shipping lanes. But, you know, the Midwest has traditionally had a lot of manufacturing for export, and that a lot of that has gone away. And a lot of the export-related jobs now in the Midwest, in Chicago area, are related to more to travel, more service-oriented, so like hotel jobs, that kind of thing. So to your point, I think that's true. As we've evolved, and then maybe that's one of the things that we're behind the eight ball.
Well, and I'm also overlooking the fact that this is a major port city, and it might not be on the coast, but there certainly historically has been a lot of shipping in and out of here as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so let's talk about healthcare. As Presence and Ascension announced this week that they are hoping to merge. Now, there was a merger earlier this year between Advocate Healthcare and North Shore that was thwarted, right? So why might the Presence merger succeed where the North Shore merger failed?
Yeah, this is a fascinating story by Kristen Schorsch because I was wondering that too. We had this merger that the feds put the brakes on, and why would Presence and Ascension Ameda, Why would that, you know, possibly get the green light? And there's two big distinct reasons why it's probably more likely to be upheld. And one of those is that it's a lot smaller, even combined. They'd have less Chicago area market share than Advocate even after the merger. So that's based on patient revenue figures. So there's less of a monopoly kind of a concern. And then another big selling point for this merger is that both Presence and Ascension suburban hospitals take on a lot more poor patients than other large systems do. They about 27% of Presence's net revenue last year came from Medicaid. For, you know, from the poor and disabled being serviced. And then for Advocate, that was only about 14%. So there are, you know, for those two reasons primarily, the thought is that this might sail through where the other merger was, they put the kibosh on it.
So because they are more likely to take in poor people, they're considered better citizens and more likely to get a pass?
Well, I think that with servicing that community, that's not considered a competitive market situation because that's just government funded. So I think you kind of just take that out of the equation.
I see. Okay.
I don't think it's more morality based, but rather, you know, is there going to be some kind of a competitive disadvantage in the marketplace for consumers of healthcare because of this merger? And the thought is, well, it's going to be smaller, and a big chunk of their services are for that government-funded healthcare, so it's less of a concern.
I see. Okay, and so if this goes forward, then they will become a bigger player in the Chicago area, a major player, but still not nearly the biggest player.
No, yeah, they'll still, even after the merger, they would still be dwarfed by Advocate itself. So that, you know, that kind of puts it into some perspective.
All right, so you're giving that one your blessing, and it's going to be okay.
I am agnostic, as they say, on that one, but I think the Feds may be more likely to approve it.
All right, so there's that. I want to talk about this dinner en blanc, but let's wrap up with that and talk right now about a story from John Pletz about using digital office broker trusts to, is this, so are they using virtual reality or what is it? They just got a big influx in cash, and what is it that's changing when it comes to them in the game?
Yeah, so I thought this was kind of a fun story because, you know, we see so many of our career outlook, you know, being pegged to what's automation going to take over, what's going to be roboticized. And Trust has raised $8 million to help automate actually finding office space of under 10,000 square feet. So does that mean, you know, that real estate brokers who I, you know, always thought would be fairly constant presence in the job market, are they going to get squeezed by technology just like, you know, factory workers?
I got you. Okay, so when it comes to the first walkthrough and all of that, people are going to be doing that via virtual reality rather, and you know, in much more detail than what they have now, photos and videos and things like that, but via virtual reality and not necessarily a walk around with a realtor.
Yeah, so basically the virtual assistant under Trust takes several steps down the road before you kind of make the final deal, and a human only comes in, you know, right when you've kind of narrowed it way down and you're ready to make the deal. Then there's a human intervention, but you know, with a lease negotiation. But up until that point, according to this you know, technology story, that the virtual assistant can help you track down exactly what you need, and then you kind of pick up the phone and say, hey, you know, let's get this deal done. And so maybe takes a lot more of the human factor out.
All right, tomorrow night, dinner en blanc, 3,600 people dressed all in white will be sitting outside somewhere in Chicago having dinner. They don't know where yet. We don't know where yet. All I know is that 3,600 people paid, what, about $40 to sit outside and eat.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to go, I heard you talking about it before the break, and I did a little research. If you go to chicago.dinerenblanc.com, you can sign up to be on the waiting list.
Yeah.
Still.
How many are on the waiting
list? I don't know, but it says 40 bucks plus a $9 membership fee, so almost 50 bucks. And for that, what you do is you show up at the appointed time at some undisclosed location. They walk you over to the real location. You have to bring your own food. It's a picnic that you bring. So you're paying $50 for the privilege of going to an undisclosed location and being led. Everybody wears white. They all sit around and wave their napkins and are convivial. They have a lot of fun, judging by the promotional video I saw. But they've sat next to the Calder flamingo statue in the past, the Lincoln Park Zoo. It does look like kind of a fun night out, but I usually don't like to pay extra to picnic.
That's the thing, right? And then I have to go buy my white trousers, so that would add even more to the expense. But it is a cool thing. So they try to find a public place, or a place that they can rent, I should say, an open spot, and one that seems to be rather underutilized. And the idea is that these are public places, places we should be, so they bring a population of people to go and eat their own food under the stars. Kind of a fun idea.
Yeah, it started in Paris in 88, and it's now in more than 70 cities worldwide. So, yeah, and I get all my white linens from the Don Johnson collection.
Yeah, well, that's because you wear linens. I wear canvas, so it wouldn't be the same store. Frank Sennett, Crane Chicago Business, nice to talk to you. We'll do it again next week.
Thank you.
All right, the physical video rentals last year dropped by 18%. So if that's the case, right, everybody's streaming the Netflix, Amazon, things like that. What's up with Redbox and how are things going with Redbox? We're going to talk to Ash Aldafrari here. He's the Chief Marketing and Customer Experience Officer for Redbox. Joins us on the Business Lunch. Welcome, Ash. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Let's just start at the beginning, because I had no idea until I started reading about you coming in that Redbox was started by McDonald's?
Yes, it was started as a way to try to drive people to McDonald's to actually, interact with them, and they thought it would drive traffic there to the store.
And so the McDonald's Corporation actually began it?
Yes.
And this would have been before the kiosks?
That's actually when they actually launched the kiosks.
Okay.
And they were very different. They looked different. They were smaller, and it's definitely evolved over time, but the whole concept of the kiosk outside the store started there at McDonald's.
And so a lot has happened since then. That was, 2002?
Yes.
So the DVD explosion and then maybe implosion. How do you guys do it? I mean, how are you doing?
Well, I don't think implosion is the right word. I think there's still a very strong desire for getting the new content at the best prices that a DVD can afford. And so we see it, almost a million rents a day strong that customers really want it.
You closed several kiosks, I think, last year.
Yep.
But this year, you've opened more than you closed.
Yes, we did. Part of the virtues of new ownership of Apollo in a private company is that they're really focused on, just not, the margin percentages. They actually focused on the fact that kiosks, customers still want them in different places and they can still make money. So they took a new look at the business and decided that, in fact, there's opportunities to add more kiosks.
I'm reading about the company. I was interested in reading about the customer.
Yeah.
Because maybe you can compare a Redbox DVD kiosk to someone who still holds on to his LPs. That's not really the case. It's a very different sort of audience.
Streaming is great. It has its a great place. It has its instant gratification aspect to it. And if you want original content and some old movies, it's great. But when it comes to new movies and new games, for some customers, the value equation just doesn't add up. They would rather save 75% by going 5 minutes to a kiosk and getting the newest movies and save 75% than streaming it.
And 75%, it's not insignificant. It's $1.50 for a DVD.
Yeah.
And I think I pay 8 or 9 or 10 bucks to watch a movie on Comcast.
You can pay a lot. And what's even better is that if you get a Blu-ray, the quality is even better. So you're saving a bunch of money to have a better experience with the movie for a simple trip to the store.
I was just texting with my son, who's somewhere in the Midwest right now. I don't know where, but and because he and his girlfriend will go to the Redbox kiosk, they love to watch horror films.
Yep.
And they say they can find horror films there that they can't necessarily on Netflix.
Yeah, our customers, we listen to our customers, and given the fact that we have, almost a million rents a day, we know what customers like and what they want. They like horror. They like action. They like comedy. So we tend to stack the boxes with those kind of movies.
Okay, so with the new kiosks coming in, are you changing strategy about where they go? I mean, where do these kiosks go?
We took a look at where customers wanted them. There's more opportunities with the Walmarts and the mass markets, the dollar stores. We're just seeing that. We talked to our customers. It was amazing. 40-some% of Americans told us that if a kiosk was closer to them, they would actually go right there instead of streaming a movie.
And so the dollar store, the appeal there is there's someone there who's saving money, right, trying to save money.
The value-driven customer is relevant for us. I mean, the Walmart customer, but we're also in the Walgreens and all different stores. So they do care about the value of a dollar, but they also want it to be convenient for them.
All right, so let me just read this text again from my son. I said, Redbox, and he goes, You mean the one at the Walmart or Walgreens? Or and then he named a third store as well.
Yeah, it's probably all within 5 minutes of him.
Probably true, yeah. And so let me ask the millennial question.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to attract millennials, and you guys say you do pretty well with them.
They, in fact, are the highest indexing customer we have. So millennials who, you know, they're just cord cutters. There's people really thinking about conscious about the value. They appreciate the value of a dollar, and they themselves want to be able to get the best movies at the what we call ridiculously easy and cheap.
So here we are 15 years after the beginning at McDonald's.
Yep.
15 years from now. What do you see?
So Redbox. So I think, you know, we're always going to try to figure out how to meet the demand of the customer. So we want to be able to offer, our vision is quality home entertainment for everyone. That is our vision. So whatever it takes for us to get the best content, the best movies, the best games to our customers at the best price, that's how we'll deliver it.
Tried streaming before. Does that mean you might try streaming again?
Yeah. You know, if clearly we're looking at it, you know, our customers, again, are telling us that what they really want is this value for the movies. But if they tell us that streaming is what they want, we'll make it happen for them.
Ash Eldefrari, the marketing officer, customer experience officer at Redbox. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Steve. Thank you.